Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. I have with me a fascinating and ultra-talented artist who's coming to see us here in Santa Barbara at this Santa Barbara Museum of Art on 14th September. And he'll be doing a talk in the evening. I have Anthony Sonnenberg here, and we're going to talk a little bit about his work. And I have to do a little bit of brag on this because his work captured me, because I love how he repurposes himself. And I love how he understands that we are material, that our bodies are material. And he uses his body in tremendous ways to picture things. And if you go to his website and take a look, you'll see what I mean. But that captured me because I thought, you know, it's so interesting that in later years as an art historian, it's about concepts, not about material. And I have a young niece who just graduated New York University. And she's an art historian, and I was kind of shocked at her syllabus, because it was about concepts. And it seems to me that art is as much about the material of art as it is the concept of art. And this artist, Anthony, that we're going to talk to, has that same, I don't know, zeitgeist, I should say, in his work. So I want to introduce him a little bit. He is speaking with us from Arkansas.
Yep.
And, you know, which is interesting. He's a professor and an artist based in Arkansas. And our wonderful museum found him and is going to bring him to Santa Barbara, like I said, September 14th. And I'm so excited to hear what he's got to say in his lecture. But I thought we'd do a little bit of an advance with him today. And Anthony, thank you so much for being here. Where are you in Arkansas?
So I'm in the northwest corner. I'm in Fayetteville. And I was saying we're kind of different than the rest of Arkansas in a lot of different ways. But one is nature-wise, because we're in the Ozarks. So we're kind of in like some low-lying mountains, which makes it about 10 degrees cooler than the rest of the state, which is a big difference. And then also we're kind of in this valley of several towns put together. And on one end is the headquarters of Walmart, which is where Crystal Bridges is and all that, and the Momentary. And then on the other end is University of Arkansas, which is the flagship university in the state. So we kind of have this bubble of money and education that really changes the demographic of where we live. So I grew up in Texas and had, you know, never really heard of it, and came here for a teaching job. And even though the job is kind of like ended, I stayed just because it was, every year I go out and I see, I'm a big plants person. I do a lot of gardening, and it's one of the most biodiverse places I've ever been. So I just, every year I go out and I go, I this thing that I thought was domesticated in another country is growing wild in a ditch. And that's the kind of, I don't know. It keeps me here for now, at least.
You know, it's funny. When I was a little girl, so my father grew up in St. Louis, and his family for years used to go to the Lake of the Ozarks for vacation. So we used to get together with my cousins who are in the St. Louis area, and we'd go to the Lake of the Ozarks for our summer vacation. So I'm very familiar with Lake of the Ozarks. I didn't know it went into Arkansas. I just thought,
yeah,
it was right.
Just the little tip kind of comes down and gets us. And so, yeah, it's really nice. And I think I think the other thing that I really find interesting about it is we were talking about cross-cultural pollination and all that kind of stuff. And I kind of have a bone to pick with Ohio, because maybe culturally it is the center of the country, but topographically, geographically, like Arkansas and Missouri and Kansas, and we're really in the center. And so it's always really interesting because at certain points in time, there's certain traditions here that are very southern, like Mississippi, Alabama. And then there's things that are like Texas, which I call hot Midwest, which is like, it's the Midwest, but it's hot and it's, I don't know, maybe there's more guns, you know, that kind of culture. But so I think it's just really interesting because like, it can feel like a lot of different places at a lot of different times, you know, because it's so in the center.
I remember, so my grandmother was born in 1900 and she lived in St. Louis all her life. And she had a little bit of a Southern accent and she said certain words in a Southern way. Worsh, for example, for wash.
Yeah, and, you know, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I understand what you're saying. There is some sort of a Southern element there. And I don't exactly know where that comes from, because it's, you know, St. Louis is closer to Chicago than it is to New Orleans. But I think the trajectory of how people emigrated or came to this country, her people came through New Orleans, mm-hmm. Mississippi
River. So they up the river, yeah.
Yeah. And then yeah. So so I guess, you know, and some of them stayed. So I who knows? But interestingly enough, anyway, I want to get to your bio and introduce you a little bit. So you know, Anthony's work is, like I said, it about materiality, but about many other things. And we'll talk about that. But he is a ceramicist and a sculptor, and he's had residencies all over the world. He came to our area to teach in 2019 at Cuesta College. He's also been teaching at Cal State Long Beach, so he's not a stranger to our area. He said solo exhibitions, many, many places, many galleries and famous galleries, Buried in Flowers in Gavlak Gallery in LA, and that was 2023, a beauty parlor conduct in Dallas, and an important gallery in Dallas. You Make Me Feel Mighty Real, and I want to talk about that that title. In 2022, Conway, Arizona, and Hendricks College, I'm Not Here, / This Isn't Happening. These are titles of his shows.
That was right in the middle of pandemic, that one.
Oh, that's why. Okay. Yeah. I'm Not Here, This Isn't Happening in 2021. A live performance as Captain Dirty Bear and his Dirty Cub Cadets. They contemplate the impossibility of performance in the physical world in 2015. As I was writing this, Tracy, of your past shows and teaching gigs, Anthony, I'm up here in my mountain cabin in Lake Arrowhead. I have a cabin about 5,500 feet up the mountain. It's very secluded. And the night before, I read that you did the live performance called Captain Dirty Bear and His Dirty Cub Cadets. We had a monstrous 400-pound brown bear demolish all our garbage up and down the street, and we could see him, huge animal. And so then I get on the computer and I find, okay, and Anthony did a performance, Captain Dirty Bear and His Dirty Cub Cadets. Tell me about that, just because I just ran into a 400-pound bear.
Well, it's funny because bears are making a comeback here in Arkansas too. Somebody was just like, oh, there's like 10 to 20 bears on our property.
Really?
But so that's kind of a character that has gone away because its purpose has kind of resolved itself. But that was happening when I was in grad school. And it was really just kind of like a way of working through queer identities, because I think, you know, part of being queer is like you kind of have like a lot of delayed kind of growing up type experiences. So like, you know, I didn't really date until I was in college because I couldn't do it in high school. And then I didn't really figure out what kind of community I belonged in, because once you figure out, oh, I'm gay, and then there's the gay world and there's so many different kind of enclaves and groups and dynamics going on, and you got to figure out that, and where do I fit in? And And I think, you know, the queer community is also kind of, I don't know, oxymoronic maybe is the word, of where it's like, you know, we are this minority and we are kind of hated upon, but then within our minority, we kind of hate upon different groups. So it's like the famous saying, which is still pretty much true, of like, no fats, no femmes, no Asians, of like this, like, don'ts of desire in the gay world, you know? And so I think, so when I was in grad school in Seattle, like figuring out that I was a bear and trying to come to terms, I think desire is always kind of going through the work in just various forms. So he was kind of a jingoist character. I don't know if that's the right word, but a character like drag designed to kind of help me get some, confidence going in that sector of my life, which I really needed at that point in time. And I think, but I think eventually I kind of got over that and started thinking more about, I think one of the reasons why I left it is because, I don't know how I felt about working with like stereotypes, not that they're, that's necessarily not true, but I think, a lot of people like that character and that character like comes back a lot. And so I think it was, it had a lot of appeal, but for me, I guess I got really interested in like doing the harder, what felt like harder work to me, of trying to bring light to all the shades of gray in between the sectors in the queer community, you know, like, and allowing some time and some breath to have like just different ideas of what it means to be gay to come out and have, you know, like have some space. And so I think like that's kind of the beginning and the end of that character. Does that answer it? And kind of I moved on to.
And it also leads me to this question about the intersection between identity and your work. I mean, mm-hmm. It's you know, this idea of who am I? You know, it's like in every visual image that I see on your website and what the museum has sent me, it's like, okay, where is Anthony here? I see the material body and I see the presence of a performance. You know, this identity issue is super important. And by the way, before we go to this next break, I just want to read for you, dear listener, this is Anthony's artist statement. There's always an artist statement that's so fascinating when you study an artist. And this is his statement. My art is a physical byproduct of the act of creating objects of beauty as an antidote to my abiding fear of the certainty of my death. And the knowledge that eventually even the memory of me will fade away. So it's a conquest of some kind involving identity and aesthetics and a tremendous amount of talent. And so I want to break this down a little bit when we get back from the break, because I have my own thoughts. And I thought a couple hours about you, Anthony. I have my own thoughts about the catalyst that you state, which is mortality. And we want to talk about that. And Richard, I think, are you there, Richard?
Why, yes, I am, America. I mean, Elizabeth.
He's making fun of Arkansas.
No. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, let's go to a quick break. And when we get back, I want to talk about these four objects, concepts.
Cool.
Desire, beauty, death, and time. And how that works in Anthony's work. So don't turn that dial. Back in a minute.
All right, you are. Thank you. Well, welcome back to Elizabeth Stewart's Arts and Antiques radio program here on AM 1290 FM 96.9 KZSB. Apparently, Elizabeth went out to Starbucks to get a cup of coffee. But we're talking with her very special guest, Anthony Sonnenberg, correct? It's great to have you here on the program. Oh, guess who just... How was Starbucks, Elizabeth?
Now, I'm at the lake house in Arrowhead, Richard, so it's a walk down the stairs.
I see.
It's not like, yeah.
Oh, second floor. You're a second floor woman, a second story woman is what you're saying.
Right. Okay. So these cabins up here, they're built on the side of the mountain, so they...
Split level. Yeah, I get you. So where were we with Anthony?
Well, one thing I wanted to bring up before we go into our big question, because I'm sure somebody at the museum is screaming. But there's two things I'm doing in Santa Barbara when I come to visit. So I'm doing a talk on Thursday evening. And then on Saturday afternoon, I think late morning afternoon, again, I should have double-checked the times before I got on here, we're doing a workshop. And the workshop's going to be really interesting because it focuses on identity. So basically what it is that I've collected images of people in power from all over the world across time. So emperors of China, chieftains of tribes in Africa, chieftains of tribes in Native Americans in North America, just everywhere I can think of, women leaders, Catherine the Great, put in a big power show and kind of go through it and then go like, if we wanted to show images of power and make ourselves look powerful, what are our options? And what do we, what says power to us? So I think I've done it several times, several places, and I'm looking forward to doing it again. It's always been fun.
So what do you think, that's a really cool thing, but what do you think, so what says power to you? I mean, it's culturally embedded, I would think, up to a point. I mean, what says power to you, Anthony?
Looking throughout history, a lot of what says power is money, because money, you can buy niceties, things, and luxury. So I've always been really interested in luxury and its connections to power and communicating power, because I think power means that you have the money to both tell people you're powerful and also show them by building castles, raising armies, doing these types of things. And so I think the way that people show wealth is really interesting across the way. So like if you look at like 17th century Chinese emperors, they're very kind of subdued portraits, but they're wearing these clothes that are extremely finely woven. And the artist has spent a lot of time, showing that weaving and that kind of stuff. And so I think for them, wealth means restraint, but showing, wealth in certain ways. Whereas like, I look to like the Mughal emperors and even though they're kind of different, but the Maharajas too, like I've been looking at the way they do jewelry and just saturated with gems and fine, and because that's them showing the wealth of the nation. And one of the things that they have is gemstones there. And but then I think it's really interesting because like America and corporate culture, and Bo Brown started this whole thing 200 years ago, but the businessman with his restraint kind of changed it in a way. And so I think from a visual dialogue, like we're in a really weird time, because like if you look through time, it's like you show people you have the money, you build the palaces, you get the portraits, you buy the shoulder, you buy the shoulders, and then you go and you conquer. And that's how you show people that you're powerful. You're gaining lands, you're showing the wealth to the people. And in America, I think it's a little bit more disingenuous about, because now I think the rich people don't want you to know that they're rich. And somehow that seems weird to me. So so I think it comes down to like having wealth and showing wealth and executing that wealth well to both kind of inspire people. And does that make sense? I don't know.
I think it does. As you were speaking, I was thinking of two separate things. Number one, I was in the Peace Corps in Africa for 3 years. And this was probably, over, 30 years or so, I was a kid. The way that I was with a couple of different tribes, three to be exact, I got moved and through Nigeria. And over across the board, the way that people showed wealth was to wear white.
No,
And
that's a big
that's
thing in all of Mr. Needed cultures, because if you're wearing white and you're in a place full of sand and you're pure white, it means you're not working. You're never getting your hands dirty. Someone else is doing that all for you. You're. So it's interesting because you see the same mechanisms getting executed over and over and over again. But it changes. For instance, I've been watching a lot of documentaries recently on mummies, both Andean and South American mummies, and they're doing, it's like a show from 20 years ago that I found on YouTube. But they're talking about when they're trying to figure out who what it is they'll get mummies who don't have identities that are in collections or wherever, and they try to do investigations on them to figure out who they were, where they came from, all that kind of stuff. So one of the things that will really tell them if they're rich or poor was, what they were eating, what was their muscle tone, what do their bones look like, are they doing hard labor, are they not? But then they would do all these chemical analysis, and they would say, oh, this mummy uses this kind of wax, and they're in southern Lima, Peru area. We know that that wax only comes from one plant in North Mexico, which is 2,000 miles away. So therefore, we know that this mummy must have been high class because the cost and the time it would take to get that there in those times, there would only be a few people in the world who would have, in their culture, who would have access to that. So sometimes I think power is hard to read from older cultures, because now that we live in this thing where, like, you can put it on a plane and fly it around the globe, and which is in its own way a transportation flex. But that, because one of the things that I was thinking that was interesting is I was on one of those mummy things, they were talking about they found a workshop of a mummifying facility that looked like, for whatever reason, it was just they put their chisels down and left. And so it was pretty much everything they found there. And they found remnants of a chemical that they know could only come from an animal in Polynesia. And they were getting it 3,000 years ago, and had it long enough to know what to do and what, so I think the flexes of power come in many different ways, and so anyways, that's kind of the things I think about power. But
Fascinating. Fascinating. I was going to say that this idea, so my first graduate degree is from the University of Edinburgh, and I spent a long time in England and Scotland, and then I married a Scot, and so we lived in Britain for many years. And I found it interesting, his dad was an honorable such and such, so he was to the manor born from a landed family, Sir somebody. And the name and his position in society said power, but men of his class and era, instead of wearing a belt, he'd wear an old beat up necktie. Instead of wearing a good shirt, it was almost like, as you say, counterintuitive. That's a very WASP culture thing to do, because it's like a fate, a sort of a facade of, I'm kind of embarrassed that I'm so powerful and so wealthy and so landed, but I'm kind of not. So I'm going to give you the opposite signal, but you'll understand that opposite signal means even more than if I wore a really fine Pierre Cardin leather belt. I'm going to wear an old tie to hang my pants up, my waist. And it was read by the people that needed to read it as power.
And I mean, I think this is like, so there's so many aspects to the work. There's the jewelry and the ceramics, which is kind of where the majority of the money for the studio gets produced. But there's room size installations, there's the performance, there's all these different aspects. And so I think one of the big challenges of my career has been to figure out how do I kind of get those under one heading roof, that I can communicate. So when I'm having studio visits and having chats with you, that I'm not just going down a million different little alleys. And so what finally kind of for me figured out was, like, the word that put it all together was decoration. And I get obsessed with it for two reasons. One, because I feel like I'm a punk rock person who loves an underdog, and decoration is the underdog of the visual world.
Totally.
And the way that I have understood that is to mean that if you were talking about decoration, you were talking about the surface of a thing. If you're talking about the surface of a thing, then it implies that there is not substance to a thing.
I
and
love
if it
it.
Doesn't have substance, then it's not worth us studying. But what I say is the visual world rules the world. The way things look and the way you see shows to people creates reality. And to me, it's just one big kind of, you know, continuous leap from RuPaul's famous saying, you know, you come out the womb naked, the rest is drag. And so I think in fashion, we see a lot of these connections, but I think I've really been focusing on like how that goes out, you know, to everything, to the houses, to the garden, you know, and really trying to expand out what is decoration, because I think a lot of people don't want to be considered decoration, even if they are, because it's considered lesser. But I think it's doing all the heavy lifting.
I agree.
Who we are, you know.
I agree totally. So this is why I wanted to talk to you. It's so interesting to me because working on my doctoral work, and I went to the university and I said, I'm an art historian. I want to do a dissertation that involves collections and collectors and connoisseurs. Well, you've got to stick with the great collections, the Annenbergs, you know, the Fricks, the this, the that. Said, no, I want to focus on the little old lady who collects ceramic frogs. They said, you can't do it. I said, why? That's a collection. It's as valid as any other collection. It is as structure building as any other collection. It is as thematic as any other collection, but it's junk. Who is to say it's junk? Mm-hmm. So I wrote about people who collected, and I still do. I still study it. People who collect light bulbs, milk cartons, ceramic frogs, who's to say? Hoarders. You say, okay, that's pejorative. No, it's not. It's not. Actually, that's a collection. And it serves a purpose. Mm-hmm. Psychologically, it serves a purpose. And it's decoration. And it is as indicative of a decorative style as any great designer's home is. It's just the same.
What I chalk it down to, from my perspective, is laziness. Because I think when you're dealing with rich people, super big collections, those kind of things, the connection of A to B and influence and impact is all very clearly laid out.
Yes.
You know what I think is a very interesting parallel? It's I was listening to the NPR news program, and they were talking about the difference between Donald Trump and DeSantis. And they were saying that
the difference between what and what?
Donald Trump and Florida's Governor DeSantis.
Oh, right. Okay.
And they were trying to figure out why is DeSantis' campaign tanking? And they said that one of the reasons is he got a lot of billionaires to give him money, but once the billionaire gives you the money, they can't give you any more money. And what Trump has is he's got this, for who knows why, this giant bank of people who will just continually send him $5, $10. And in the end, that $5 or $10 from the little people is more and more reliable to keep a campaign going than getting all the money from the billionaires. So I think even though it's easy to say like, oh, we can see the billionaires giving the $30 million and all that makes sense, it's actually that what the reason that Trump is beating him right now is because the base of the small people and not the large donors. So I think, but again, it's hard to see that because it's, you know, it's just hard. We don't know who those people are, those kind of things. So I think, and that's what's hard about decoration. And another thing is I think right now we're in a period where, you know, identity is very important and re-evaluation of identities and values of identities and who's important and who's not. And people are using portraits to do that because portraits are really great at doing that very directly. But my argument is that a portrait only does so much. What about the clothes you're wearing, the rings you're wearing? You know, there's so many different weird little intricacies of culture, like Paisley, the journey of Paisley from India to England to back, you know, that explains so much about the relationship of England and India and the hate and the bad and the good and, you know, and there's love and there's beauty in, you know. And so I think that story says more to me about a certain type, about certain aspects of a country's relationship and the people's, you know, identity anyways. So I think what I've been kind of referring it to is like just in the last 20 years, we're finding out that like trees and all these things are communicating with each other, with sharing networks with fungi underground. And we just didn't know because it was underground. And it's so hard to see these things happening underground. And you have to work harder, but suddenly we're realizing that like what's happening underground is what's really, you know, like controlling a lot of what's happening in the forest. And so I think decoration is like that fungus. It's there, we don't think about it, it's not important. And so it's doing its work quietly and under the ground, but still it's doing a lot of work. And so I think I'm just the one fighting for it, but I think it's hard to connect those dots. And it involves talking about things like beauty and desire, which curators and a lot of contemporary instances don't like to talk about.
Right.
Because I think it gets muddy and gray.
Right.
What is beauty? What is decoration? These are hard questions, you know.
Right. But this is, it's so amazing to me that you focused on this, because it is the fungus. It's there. It's everywhere. It's the mosquito. It's something that's everywhere. I mean, in my world, you know, I'm going into a house. One house has this look as far as decorative art, objet d'art. It has this look, has this kind of furniture, this kind of rug, this kind of blah, blah, blah. But that's horrific. Nobody wants it. But this, everybody wants. And then it'll change. And then, you know, that's the whole connection with consumerism as well. But yes, definitely there. You can walk into certain, I walk into people's houses 2 hours a day in what I do. You can walk in the house and you can read the house just by what's in the house. You can read the people by what's in the house. It's a signal. You know, the decorative objects are signals to you. And that's a really interesting life, you know, to be like, okay, this is it a sign? Is it a symbol? Is it a signal? What is it? But you know it, you know, so yeah. It it's embedded in it's highbrow, lowbrow, medium brow, taste brow. All of these are, you know, it's like you said, class. It's indicative.
Yeah, I mean,
very important.
I think, you know, and it's sometimes it's hard to see, or it doesn't get seen a lot when it's working in ways that we're used to seeing, when it's holding up things of power that we're used to seeing. Banks look a certain way, presidents look a certain way, you know, and I know that, and that fits with what I'm going on. But suddenly they become really important and really obvious when they start working against the common quo. So when Obama wore the taupe suit, people talked about it for weeks because it was this faux pas. Why a suit's not important unless it's the wrong suit. Suddenly it is. Is painting your nails important? Well, apparently it is if Drake does it. And he's a man and he's supposed to be straight, and straight people, you know, and I guess he's Black, and maybe they're not supposed to have the same connection with femininity as other racism, but he's doing it. And suddenly, you know, to certain people, it's a big deal.
And I get it. Richard's giving us a sign. We got to go to quick break. I would love to talk more about this, but I also want to talk about some of the interconnections that you found. And I want to bring us back a little bit to that. This identity thing is so fascinating, especially the decorative clues that become actually boulders falling from the sky. You know, mm-hmm. The catalyst that you use to create. I'm interested to know what gets you creating, Anthony, when we get back from the break. Hey, Richard, let's go to quick break. We get back. I'm celebrating the fact that Anthony Sonnenberg is going to come and visit us at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. He's going to speak on the 14th, and then that weekend he's doing an intensive workshop about identity. How pertinent that is for today. Don't turn the dial. Back in a minute. It's Elizabeth Stewart. Fascinating discussion with Anthony Sonnenberg, who's coming to Santa Barbara to lecture at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. He's doing a talk on the 14th of September, but he's also that weekend doing a workshop. And the workshop focuses on identity and we are learning a little bit in advance about some of the themes that make Antony create Antony a good artist, a great artist, a great mind. And we're learning a little bit about what impetus he has to create. And some of the questions that I have, you know, he was talking about this big umbrella of things that he does. So he does installations, performance art, small pieces, large pieces, ceramics, et cetera, et cetera. Two-dimensional, three-dimensional performance. You know, there's a big tent of things that Antony does. And then he also thinks about identity, and he thinks about desire, beauty, death, and time. And all those are concepts that the modern lecturer in visual arts tends to stay away from. I don't know why, but they do. I have some pretty good ideas why they do. But, you know, we were talking during the break, fascinatingly enough, that we both share, Richard, can you believe, we both share the same passion, which is to go into junk stores, thrift stores, little by-the-way places, estate sales. And Antony challenges himself and buys paintings that he, are two-dimensional, probably works of art. Things that are under $100 he likes to find. I myself, everybody knows that listens to my program, I have three storage lockers full of that kind of stuff. Why do we do it? Why do we do it? Why do we challenge ourselves that way? So Antony, I want to know what challenges you to create. What's your spur?
I think we'll start on very basic levels and then maybe we'll kind of build up. So I think on a very basic level, like I have a real passion for objects. Like I just love them. And they bring me a lot of joy. And I think some people, you know, like they get a thrill when they go to Vegas or they gamble or something like that. And I think that same kind of thrill, that joie de vivre that makes me continue on in this crazy world, is, you know, that thrill of finding something, but also making something special, you know. So I think that kind of excitement keeps it going. And I think we were kind of talking about, like, mortality plays a big role in the work. And I'm not really teaching right now, but when I was, you know, I'm trying to sit there, tell students, trying to get their direction, and it really makes you question, like, well, what are my directions? Am I solid in my own thing? I'm trying to push these people off, and I'm maybe not so sure my own thing. And I think what it really came down to is, I didn't even read a book. I heard a podcast about a book, a person talking about mortality or immortality, and the various ways that could play itself out. You could live forever like a vampire, or download your brain into a computer, or you know, this, they think, one of the reasons why religion is there. Well, he said the interesting thing about death is that it's impossible for the mind to understand what death is, because it means you don't exist. And because you've only ever experienced existence, you can't have any knowledge of what non-existence is. And so that kind of, like, that wall that we keep hitting is a lot of what, like, is why we make art and that kind of stuff, because our mind doesn't like things that we can't figure out and move through easily. So he said that the mind has always been working on ways to think past this. And the way to think past it is to think about a life after, because you can't know what death is. So you can imagine a life after. And so they were saying, you know, like, so then people invented the idea of a soul. Anyways, for me, what it came down to is thinking about memory and leaving objects behind. And I may not have children and I may not do these things, but I've left a point of view of what beauty is in the world. And I think that keeps me going and striving me.
I love it. I love it. You know, the idea that so just a little aside. The house that I'm in now in Lake Arrowhead's a little cabin, and I bought this for a family compound. And I thought, oh, you know, I needed to restore it. And usually places up here around in the mountains, they sell places furnished, and the paintings on the wall, everything is just, you know, sell the whole darn thing. Mm-hmm. I had a hard time getting rid of the things that were in this house, because I thought, okay, it's been a rental for 37 years, this particular cabin, and every renter brought something else, and I could feel, you know, what those objects were telling me. And I ended up Anthony, restoring a lot of them and not, you know, reclaiming their lives. Almost like, I don't want you to die. I don't want you to go to the dump like everything else, you know, in this world. I want you to have a new, that's why I call my things that I collect like junk, that I collect orphans, because I want mm-hmm. them to be included in a statement of groupness, of family somehow. And that is not a good look for today. People are like, oh, you know, this is, you know, you're just obsessed with objects. Well, no, I'm obsessed with what the objects are saying, mm-hmm. Not the object. It's what the objects are saying to me. Richard.
Well, okay.
Richard, we have Anthony, hold that thought 1 second. We'll go to a quick break, and then I want to hear what you have to say about that, because I bet if I walked into your house, I'd love it.
I think you would.
Don't turn that down. Back in a minute with Anthony Sonnenberg. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. The great pleasure to be speaking with Anthony Sonnenberg, who's coming to our museum to lecture 14th of September. And then that weekend, make a note that he'd be doing a workshop focusing on identity. We were just talking about his interest in objects and materiality. And just very quickly, I want to just briefly, we have 4 minutes, Anthony, but briefly, the intersection of desire, beauty, death, and time. Very quickly, tell me about this. There's a really interesting graphic example of this on Anthony's website. Tell me about it.
It just came about like really trying to boil down the prostitutes' most basic things and figure out a way to say like these are the foundations of the things and they're coming in. And so those are, when I was like really trying to boil it down, those are the things that I think kept coming back in one form or another. I think one of the things that helped inform it is, and I'm not a philosophical expert at all, but I get bits and pieces and they really help kind of move me forward. So one thing that I really think about a lot is Nietzsche's idea of why the Greeks invented beauty. And he says that the Greeks were one of the first cultures to recognize that existence was suffering, which I think is interesting because it's this connection of East and West philosophies of, you know, Buddhism and that kind of stuff. And that they would make these objects, tragedies specifically, to kind of help, I guess the way I viewed it is to be like the sugar that gets through the, you know, because reality is so senseless. And senselessness and orderless are not conducive to human beings, that we have to find it somehow, some way. And so making objects and sharing that experience of the objects and beauty is kind of this really fundamental survival mechanism, basically. And so I think that's where that came in. And then I think the time comes in because I've just always been somebody that's trying to figure out, like, just always looking back at his history and looking at the cycles and looking about like what is something that's maybe unique, you know, like that's just a temporary thing that's a symptom of our society where we're at, and what are things that I see coming back again and again and again. So I that really helped me kind of put a kind of capital on emotions like jealousy and things like, because you see people in making illogical choices all the time throughout history. For good and bad and all these kind of things. And so I think it really helped me put an impetus on emotion and those kind of things more than the intellectual side, because I felt like I could trust that more and see it play out more consistently. And then death, I think, just for what we were talking about before, I think it's just one of those constant little spurs in the back of our side. Our mind can't move around it, and so we're constantly trying to like make a pearl, you know, like it's the sand that we have to anchor around, you know, to make our lives move forward. And that pearl ends up being, you know, art in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, what you were asking me, what keeps me going too. And I think time plays an important part, because the more and more I make art and get in situations where we're in crises and we're pulling through, or good or bad days. Am I making good work? Am I making bad work? And it really helps me to kind of the materiality of things. I can go look at an Egyptian temple, the temples in Angkor Wat, and I feel like somewhat be able to put myself in that craftsman's shoes. I want to do a good job. I got to keep the boss happy. I got to keep myself happy, you know, like, maybe they're not artists in the same way we think of artists, but that thing of creation and taking something from in your head and putting it out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, that's timeless.
That's absolutely. Thank you so very much, Anthony. I look forward to seeing you.